most people don't want to be just straight up told, here's a piece of paper, this is what you're going to have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. People aren't really looking for that anymore. They're looking more for strategies, and they really do seem to latch on to when I tell them two solid meals a day and a snack in between. That's kind of my pillar there too, is let's eat twice really good. Many people have found that strategy to be what they were looking for.
I'm Ben Grenell, part of the early startup team here at Levels. We're building tech that helps people to understand their metabolic health, and this is your front row seat to everything we do. This is a whole new level.
If you followed nutrition for a while, you'll have seen that it continues to evolve. There are lots of fads, there are lots of trends, and there's new science that continues to come out. It shows people different ways in which food affects their health. Well, this is very much the case for one of our members, Julie Cotterill. Julie's been a registered dietitian and focused on nutrition with her clients for more than 25 years. And over the course of this time, she has seen everything oscillate as far as what to eat and what to avoid, and sometimes those things come full circle. And so when Julie started using a CGM, she had data that gave her a feedback loop so she could have insight into the way that her body was metabolizing certain foods, the way that different lifestyle choices made an impact on things like her glucose variability and her average glucose levels. And so CGM has been one factor of many in her journey of health and wellness. Here's the conversation with Julie. It would be awesome to kick it off and dig into a little bit more about your background. You've got such an interesting background as a registered dietitian for 25 years now.
I know. I was doing the math and I couldn't believe it. I thought, I really have been a dietitian that long.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot.
Well, over the past 25 years, like food trends and the philosophies have changed and evolved so much, partially because of, we'll call it trends, and partially because of science. But now we get things like CGM and other technology that allows us to see, allows us to have a different lens on the data side of things. So there's a bit more quant coming into some of the qualitative things about the way people physically felt by eating certain foods. So would be cool to go into your background, how you got into being a dietitian, and just walk through to present day.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I sure didn't plan this to become a dietitian. And in fact, I started off life. I was born in 1970 in the age of processed foods, and I loved processed foods, and I didn't eat a single fruit or vegetable until I was a teenager. So I have a very picky, I can empathize even with young children or even adults now that tell me that they don't like a vegetable or something. I'm like, hey, I was there. I had to teach myself how to like a lot of different things. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I got a degree in biology, and the last elective that I took was a nutrition course. And so I asked my professor, could I go into nutrition with this? And she said, oh, absolutely. And plus, I already had an emphasis, like I did gymnastics and then cheerleading and then running. And I was very interested in health and that sort of thing. So I ended up going and getting a master's degree in nutrition. And as I got started on that, I realized, hey, if you want to do anything in this world, you need to become a registered dietitian. So I went that route. And so I became a registered dietitian in 1996. And then I've had different jobs along the way since then, depending on, I'm a mom too. So, I didn't always have the opportunity to be working like in the hospital setting or whatever. I've done outpatient stuff and just kind of scrambled around, because nutrition kept changing and my thoughts about nutrition kept changing. And I had to kind of, I sort of parted ways with the traditional nutrition advice. Like I reached a point where working in a hospital wasn't really going to work for me because I didn't necessarily agree with all of the guidelines that as a registered dietitian, I'm obligated to. You know, that's a whole different system. And, you know, I've watched as all these different health coaches have come on the scene, you know, and my husband's a physician. He's family practice trained, and he actually is an ER doctor now. But we've had conversations about that. And he says, you know, as a dietitian, you are really designed to work in an institutionalized place, a hospital, a nursing home, something that requires, you know, your expertise and your credential. And so then when I go wanting to work and promote health and wellness and stuff like that, you know, I'm just competing against a health coach, you know, somebody else who just happens to have an interest in nutrition and who many times could have more experience than me. You know, I had to switch gears and make some changes from a career standpoint as things changed, my ideas changed, and wanting to still help people. Like, I have that inner drive to help people. Mm-hmm. You can't study it this long. I would read nutrition book after nutrition book, even if I wasn't trying to get continuing education for it. You know, like, that's just what I do. And it sort of amazes me sometimes when I talk to patients who now will say, just tell me what to do. Like, I don't want to read about it. I don't want to think about it. I just want you to tell me what to do. And I'm just like, seriously, how could you not, you know, care or want to read about it? But that's truly how some people are. It just doesn't interest them. They just want to get through their day and try to be as healthy as they can without, you know, knowing every detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I'd imagine that when it sounds like you had that inner conflict of when working in the hospital where the prescriptions, we'll call it that, it's very prescriptive of here's what you have to have. And that we won't even go down that rabbit hole because it's a very, very deep one. But the same thing goes when these food trends change, right? Like, this is the latest diet, and that people feel almost conflicted themselves where they don't even, everything becomes noise. There's a point, and the more that everyone's had the ability to amplify their own agenda and their own messages, then it becomes even more challenging. So they say, like, just tell me what to do. The challenge, and this is where like CGMs and data comes in, is you know firsthand, like, what works for one person does not necessarily work for another person for many reasons, whether it's lifestyle choices, whether it is genetic makeup, whether it is stage of life, something that you've talked about in the article, the member spotlight article that we did with you. And so it's, how have you worked through that with clients where you have to give them guidance, but knowing that it's really hard to be prescriptive and you still want people to like generally understand the difference between, let's be hyperbolic, like a Twinkie and a Brussels sprout, like very different outcomes. So if somebody says, like, I don't really care to know, just tell me which one to eat. It's like, you should understand, you should still understand the foundation of like why you are eating X and Y together versus like avoid Z completely. Right. Just don't do that. So how have you worked through that, knowing that it's like, it's almost Sisyphean, like you're trying to work with so many people, but at the same time, like help them in their best interest and like do something that's intrinsically motivating.
Right. That's been my greatest struggle because I don't want to lead people down the wrong road. And that's why I do a lot of self-experimentation. I'm, you know, always trying to figure things out and change, you know, do whether it's low carb or it's a vegetarian type of a plan. And people are confused and they do want to know, like, should I do keto? You know, it's like they want to grasp on to an entire food philosophy and now, or I want to be plant-based. I'm going to be, you know, vegetarian. And I deal with all of that when I talk to people, trying to understand what their motivations are, what their, you know, where they're getting their information, try to explore that with them when they say, I'm trying to be plant-based. And I'm like, okay, can you tell me more about that? Why are you feeling motivated to do that sort of thing? I really like to figure out like all their motivations and what the context of their life is, what their family situation is, and who all is pulling at them. but also understanding that they don't have to have one specific food philosophy. It's more like, and I've had to come to this realization over time, is that there are some pillars that seem to be true no matter what, whether you want to be vegetarian or you want to be keto or whatever. You need a certain amount of protein, you know, like some people I'm not sure I want to eat any protein or not, or, you know, I don't care which plan you're on, you need some protein. Also, we're in a culture where we eat just way too many carbs. I mean, that's a really clear message I can give to anybody. I don't care if you're plant-based or not, just eating a ridiculous amount of carbs, your body can't handle that many. And, you know, just trying to differentiate for people. It gets scientific sometimes. I mean, it's hard to not, like, just the difference between, are you a carb burner or a fat burner? And pretty much everybody I talk to is carrying a lot of extra body weight. And, you know, right there, it's like, why are you carrying all that extra body weight? Well, because you are a carb burner. You are not accessing that body fat. You're not metabolically flexible. So some of the other pillars that I've come to that I didn't know when I first started would be like an eating window. I mean, that wasn't anything I ever, you know, heard about, learned about. And now it's all coming, a lot of studies and everything are backing up how eating in a tighter eating window is, you know, so much more beneficial, no matter where your calories are coming from. And so, like, that's something that I can get into with people pretty quickly, is understanding when is the first food going into your body and when is the last food going into your body of the day, and can we condense that eating window regardless of, you know, what foods you're eating. And then, you know, processed foods. I mean, we know that there's an awful lot of stuff that's in the processed foods that's not doing us any favors. And so, you know, as I explore their diet with them and find out, you know, how much cooking are you doing at home versus how much are you just grabbing and going from restaurants, because food quality and just bringing more things into your body that, you know, aren't necessarily health promoting. And it wouldn't matter, you know, which type of diet you're on, whether you're doing a vegetarian diet or a keto diet, you know, I mean, food quality matters. And I do try to, you know, bring that to light with people as much as I can, you know, during our conversations.
When you, I know that you've tried so many different things, but you had this period where you experimented or went deeper into a ketogenic diet and then sort of backed off because of certain learnings, where it sounds like you went from not eating carbs altogether and then starting to maybe pair them with fat, fiber, protein, introduce them back in, because the natural state is like, great, I'm going to just only eat protein and like high fat foods. And so people over index on going. I think that happens almost with like any new, we'll call it new way of eating, whether it is a prescriptive diet that people are trying to follow or maybe changing their food philosophy. But it's like, you go so deep, let's make an assumption right now and make up an example, because they're fun, is somebody wants to go plant-based and they want to get more fiber, and they just all of a sudden start eating tons and tons of beans. And it's like, well, those are also higher in carbohydrates. You got to pair those. So it's like, anytime you go too deep on one in one direction, then it can steer you off course of what you're trying to achieve. So what were some of the things that when you started changing the way that you ate and bringing it into stage of life, like, how did you figure it out? Was it data? Was it the way that you physically felt? Like, what was it that sort of made you evolve this idea of the way that you could eat to feel better?
You know, it's kind of funny because okay, so I come out of being a registered dietitian, come out of my internship, I start my first job, and I thought I knew everything then, right? I mean, I just came out of school, and it's all low fat, and, you know, just anything we can do to eat low fat. And that's when my husband, and he was in residency at the time, and some of his fellow residents, they were all trying out the either Atkins or Carbohydrate Addicts diet. And so along with that, you know, they were all doing it and losing weight. and I'm over here on my low fat pedestal, right? And not feeling 100% great, but I mean, I've got that philosophy in my mind. And they're losing weight and I'm sitting here struggling to figure out what I'm going to eat that's going to taste good and look good and all that. That was my first point of questioning the low fat scheme. Mm. And knowing I wasn't feeling my best, my cholesterol numbers were high, my triglycerides were high, but I was latched on, you know, to that food philosophy. And so then as an experiment, I tried doing a lower carb approach. And that, I mean, this is around 2000, 1999, maybe 1998. Mm-hmm. And I felt better and I lost weight. And I've never been like, I'm 5'4". I've never really been more than like 128. I mean, I usually fluctuate 115, 120. But at that time I was about 128 and I went down immediately to 123. And I saw that it was like not that hard to do. And I was like, why have I been on that pedestal of you've got to be low fat, you know, to make everything work and feel good? And I mean, what most people are trying to do is lose weight. I mean, they want to feel good, but dang, they want that scale to go down too. And it's just, so I realized then that I didn't know everything. And I have been curious ever since. So that's kind of, I started, you know, reading books that would seem peripheral, you know, like that's not what the American Dietetic Association is telling you, you know, and, you know, I understand they're a big ship that's not going to change course very quickly, you know, and there's, but they've been evolving. I will give them credit because, you know, there was a time when if I wanted to do my continuing education hours, I only got to pick from XYZ. And now, like I just read Dr. Gundry's new book, Unlocking the Keto Code, and it's already listed as something I can get continuing education for. So, you know, their minds have expanded and, you know, mine have too. And so, you know, just for me personally, just understanding that there isn't one right way, but we're looking for metabolic health. We're looking for metabolic flexibility. I mean, you can't listen to any of these podcasts now and not hear somebody talking about that. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal. And so I think, you know, to answer your question about the ketogenic diet, like I think there's some great aspects to that. And for somebody who is stuck in glucose burning and they don't know how to use that body fat and they can't go from meal to meal without, you know, they need a snack. They need that hit. They need to learn how to burn fat. And so it could be that a ketogenic diet or a very, very low carb diet that shuns everything else that could potentially be healthy, you know, do that for a while because you've got to change the way your mitochondria make energy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I can see it as a means to an end, you know, for just the general person who just isn't able to burn fat very well. But does that have to be their way of life forever? No, they could learn to expand back out. And that's really where I am in my own understanding of it is trying to understand, you know, how much carbohydrate can I get away with without having an allegiance to a ketogenic diet? Because I don't really think it's about just making a whopping number of ketones. I think it's for the fact that your body can make ketones and that, you know, that's where the benefit of that shorter eating window comes in, the longer fasting window that your body has the downtime can start generating those ketones. And so, you know, that's like when I'm coming back to my pillars, that's why that's one of those pillars that doesn't seem to change for me is your body. You got to give your body downtime to process through and reset and regenerate. And, you know, and so that goes with any diet. It doesn't matter whether you're vegetarian or ketogenic or what you are. And so that when I was experimenting with ketogenic diet and thinking I want these higher levels of ketones and I'm now, of course, I've got the ketone monitor going and I'm, you know, just like I've got the CGM on right now. but I love to monitor these things. And so I was, what's it going to take for me to make some ketones? And I ended up just as frustrated as a lot of people do. If you think the goal is I should be walking around with ketones of 1 or 1.5 or 2, you know, I mean, you're going to have to do a 2 or 3 day fast to do that. And is that, you know, practical or realistic for most people? Very often that, you know, that doesn't jive with life. I mean, that doesn't. So it kind of makes me question, okay, well, ketones might be good, but maybe not to that level. Maybe mm-hmm. we want just these lower levels of ketones. You know, it's like the having a high level of ketones is maybe no more beneficial than having a high blood sugar. Mm-hmm. They're both, you know, energy sources that are in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I don't think that that the ketones are as important as just being one of those background things that we're looking for. And so I don't have to have an allegiance to a ketogenic diet, but I do have an allegiance to a lower carb diet. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be 50 grams a day or less. But coming back to what I was saying with the initially with my husband and the carbohydrate addict diet and all that, I learned, this was my first job actually with being a dietitian, and standing in front of a group of patients that I was doing a diabetes support group meeting. And I had used the calculations that I was supposed to go by, which is 50 to 65% of calories from carbs. And so I'm telling these patients, based on this 1500 calorie or 1800 calorie plan, whatever, you should be able to eat 50 to 65% of calories as carbs. And when I did the math, I mean, that's 200 grams, maybe 250 grams of carbs per day. And I mean, the hands shot up in the air. They're like, if we eat that many carbs, I mean, our blood sugar will go through the roof. And I'm like, but the guideline says this. And I'm like doing this head scratch, like, what? It's not working out then. I mean, and how much protein could you eat, or how much fat could you eat? So I realized then that the carbs are what has to, you know, come down, however much that might be. So I've been preaching personally a lower carb plan, not necessarily a ketogenic plan, but a lower carb plan for a long, long time. And even back then, that was back, like I said, around 1998, 99. And I had cardiologists that would refer, one cardiologist would refer patients, and they needed to do Dean Ornish. They wanted me to instruct patients on Dean Ornish. And I don't know if you're familiar with that plan. It's vegetarian, very plant-based, not too much protein. Versus I had some that were saying Atkins, and they just wrote that in the medical chart, Atkins. And so, I mean, it was like I was torn both ways right then. And so it's been ever since then that I have realized that there was more than one approach, but I have consistently felt like a lower carb plan was better. And the way I define that is about 100 grams of carbs per day or less. And I find, and I remember when Mark Sisson came out with his thing, and I share that like with patients, it's on my patient education materials, is his carbohydrate curve, if you're familiar with it, that, I mean, you go over 100 grams and it just becomes a lot more difficult to, unless you're very active. And I do have a son who's a runner, and he can get away with those carbs, but he's constantly, you know, using them up. Most people I talk to are not very active. And so I just feel like, let's get you under, that's another pillar for me, is let's get you under 100 grams of carbs any way we can. Let's do some carb swaps. You know, maybe instead of your pasta, you're going to eat the spaghetti squash, you know, something like that. Like, let's get some strategies in place that are going to help you lower the carbs without you necessarily feeling like you have to adhere to a ketogenic plan, you know.
When you started using a CGM, were there anecdotes or takeaways where you could link the way that you physically felt prior to seeing data back to it to be like, oh yeah, that feeling, because you all of a sudden have the data? So like the classic example is, which so many people can relate to, is the head nod at 2:30 in the afternoon where your head's about to hit the keyboard, and you're, if somebody works at a desk and they're sitting there and it's like, they can't figure out why. And so that it means like, I need more coffee. I didn't get enough sleep. Like, just like the wrong, like you're trying to connect the dots, but it's like the wrong thing altogether. And it's like, oh no, the Jimmy John's sandwich that you ate like 30 minutes ago is making you go hypoglycemic. And so as soon as you see the data, it's a lot easier to go, wait, for like the past 20 years, that thing that I was always feeling, because it's like, it doesn't have to be at the desk. It can be anytime you start to go hypoglycemic, you can feel it. It's so visceral once you know the data. Like, you don't need the CGM to see. You can just like feel all the sensations about it. And so were there any points for you where you were able to link back the way that you felt as you evolved your eating philosophy, and then maybe some of the things that you passed along to clients of like, this is what happens with this, because you were able to connect those dots a little bit better?
Yeah, you know, I was already doing a low carb diet, you know, when I started. And mm-hmm. so I don't have the same aha moments as somebody would who is eating that, you know, they're eating oatmeal that they think is healthy, which could be, but, or a bowl of cereal. I mean, I talked to plenty of people that they're, or the cereal bar or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like I wasn't doing any of those things. So, you know, that part of it, I couldn't really assess. And that's probably why when I did my other interview with you guys that it came, I said, actually, relative to alcohol is one of mm-hmm. my things, is because, you know, we like to drink a little wine or something like that in the evening. And that would be the time that I would start to experience what I felt like was a low blood sugar. Mm. And, you know, this is in the context of a low carb diet, which as I've understood more about alcohol now, I understand that, you know, your tolerance goes down. You need to hydrate more. There's all kinds of things that you can do to make it better. But you also just have to understand that you truly don't tolerate it as well. Mm-hmm. And so wearing the CGM showed me that indeed I was experiencing a low blood sugar. And, you know, that could potentially be one of the reasons why alcohol paired with a meal could have a health benefit in moderation. Because I think sometimes people think, oh, well, then my blood sugar went down. And it's almost like they think those calories disappeared. And the calories don't disappear. Your body's just shoving that energy away for later while it metabolizes the alcohol. Mm-hmm. So, but I think it it comes back to understanding that moderation is important. Staying super hydrated is important. Not drinking too late at night, you know, that sort of a thing. I think when I saw my blood sugar go down, you know, then if you're going to adhere to a lower carb plan, then, you know, you're going to reach for cheese or some nuts or something like that, that's low carb, that's still staying with your plan. But the truth is, you know, if you have a low blood sugar, those foods don't bring it back up very quickly, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you do exceed, you know, what moderation would be, you have a second glass or a third glass of wine, whatever it is, and you start to experience that low blood sugar, you probably need to pull out the crackers or, you know, something. Maybe it's gluten-free, I don't know, but, you know, that's going to help bring that blood sugar back up. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, some cheese by itself isn't going to. So I think what I learned is just repeating back that moderation is important. And the other thing I realized too is habits. So I haven't talked about this, but this is one of my other emphasis that I really, I think is very interesting. I've done a lot of studying about habits and just understanding that, I mean, because when it comes to alcohol, we can be in a habit of drinking it, but we could also be in a habit of not drinking it. But studying people up and trying to understand what their habits are, what defines their life, that's been very helpful to me as far as counseling, and then trying to figure out what habits would help them more in the future. And, you know, so like I've established some habits around the alcohol, which is, maybe you need an alcohol window of time. And, you know, there's something to that saying of don't drink before 5 o'clock, you know, or people say it's 5 o'clock somewhere, you know, well, mm-hmm. don't be drinking all day long. I mean, you shouldn't be anyway, but tying it to the meal, knowing that your blood sugar is probably going to be a little bit lower. So if you enjoy that glass of wine with your meal, that's the beginning and the end of it. So don't carry on after dinner and, you know, the bottle of wine's already open. Well, you better pump it and keep it for tomorrow because you don't need to keep on drinking. Mm. So I don't know. I mean, that's just an example. I don't mean to talk all about alcohol but a lot of people ask me about it. I mean, that's one of the things that comes to light when they're when I'm counseling them is I'll ask them just like what beverages they consume. And I'm thinking more about coffee and tea and sugary drinks and all that. Let's clean that up real quick. But along with it is, you know, how much alcohol are you consuming too? And are you using that daily or, you know, and trying to give the best advice I can based on that too, is, mm-hmm. is, you know, how can that fit into your life if that's what you want and you can do it responsibly, but not necessarily. And then, you know, you could use a CGM to see what it's doing for you. But I've been able to tell people, I've worn a continuous glucose monitor and I've been able to see that it does bring my blood sugar down. So, you know, it's not something that you want to do unless you do have food planned just to help keep it from going too low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's alcohol is a very interesting one because we stay neutral in the sense where we don't want to be prescriptive and say, do this or don't do that. But what is important to note are things, there are certain things where we'll say alcohol is not a glucose mitigation strategy. Like when some people think, oh, great, I can go have this thing because I'm going to have the wine with it. And to your point of habits, like that's not the habit that we encourage people to build. Again, staying neutral. What we do is highlight data points or any research that is available where if we talk about alcohol and say, cool, what are some of the other implications of having, let's just say it's that one glass of wine at night. Well, we know that data will show us it gives you poorer quality sleep, especially like the later you consume it. And again, consuming it with or without food, but alcohol consumed, let's just say it was 7 p.m. and somebody's going to bed at 9, they will have lower quality sleep. Lower quality sleep leads to higher average glucose or higher glucose variability, more insulin resistance in a day, and that starts to compound over time. So when something becomes a habit and somebody's having one or two glasses of wine every night with or without a meal, and the later they have that or beer, whatever they are drinking, then you start to go, well, the thing I'm trying to get control of, my glucose, it's being offset by this other thing that it has now become a habit, right? And so just understanding all the implications of like, what does this one input do and how does it affect the other output of what the goal is? And if somebody's goal is, hey, I want to, whether or not this is the right approach or mindset, somebody might say, I want to lose weight. Well, you have to get, and they are insulin resistant. You have to get your insulin under control, and there's so many lifestyle habits where it can't be just change diet, but maintain these other, we'll call it these other lifestyle choices the way that right. They were in the past. So everything is so, so tightly linked in so many different ways that it's a matter of understanding these things, kind of like, eating poorly, but saying it's okay. I'm eating a ton of processed foods and it's okay because I exercise a ton. It's like, well, no, it's not really okay. Like that's not the way to approach it. There's too many factors that need to change. So I would imagine that when you're working with clients, it's ongoing, especially when people say, I don't really want to understand. It's like, well, you need to understand how all these things are linked because it's not just, there's not some we always say glucose is not a panacea, but there isn't some, like, there's the strategy. Just do that. Just exercise. Just eat well. It's do everything. Sleep well. Understand how your lifestyle choices have to change if you have the goal of, let's say, weight loss or whatever someone's goal is. And it'd be interesting to go into how you've evolved and adapted your lifestyle choices or even just your diet given stage of life and some of the things that you've talked about as you've been going through menopause and to understand like how women's health changes over time and how the way that you approach things evolves.
Yeah. I have definitely made changes. One of the things is just to shrink the eating window. I do really like that. That's one of the things I end up talking to patients about too, just the benefits of fasting. And although you can't push too hard on that for some people. And like you said, with menopause, it could be that a woman's body as it's changing may or may not be able to tolerate a super long period of fasting. So we can't elevate fasting to the point that we think, you know, do or die, you know, it's, do what you can, listen to your body. So, you know, and coming back to the sleep, that's really one of the starting points I do. I never would have talked to a patient about sleep years ago. And now I might spend 10 minutes talking to them about their sleep. And that's an I try to give them structure to their day. And so we do talk about, you know, how many meals and things that they're eating a day, and are they stopping within 2 to 3 hours of bedtime? And that's something that's extremely important to me too. And I have my Aura ring, you know, I'm a gadget girl over here. So I study my sleep, and I was studying that, you know, alongside of using the CGM as well and trying to pair all these things up. I do know how important sleep is, and, you know, teaching people that that is your reset button. That's when your body does its repair work, and mm-hmm. you need to do everything you can to get that, you know, the best quality of sleep you can, and as long as you can. And so that's something that we really work on. And then extending the fast from that point as much as you can. And I've been able to watch my, you know, my own blood sugar through that morning time and see how it's responding. I think just understanding that you can go for a period of time and not necessarily need to eat anything if you can teach yourself to be more fat adapted, but that's a process. A lot of times people want the easy answer. They want it to happen right now. And, you know, it does take time to become fat adapted. If you've been very dependent on carbs and being a sugar burner, then you've got to give yourself time to make some adaptations so that your body can go for longer.
The adaptation part is interesting because this ties into the mindset around goals. So often we'll hear people that will say, hey, my goal is I want to lose weight, right? And sometimes that's not actually what the outcome that will make them content, if you want to call it that, because weight is an interesting thing where let's make an assumption that somebody isn't overweight to the point where they want to lose a little bit of weight, but it's not like 50 pounds, right? It's that they want to physically feel better and they want their waistline to change. And so they don't actually, sometimes by changing eating habits and sometimes by getting things like their metabolic health under control, they're not actually losing weight, but they'll lose like 4 inches around their waist. And they go, I don't understand. I didn't lose any weight, but they feel really good. They've started exercising. They've started building some muscle. They've started, their waistline has changed. The way that they're toned is their body tone and where their weight distribution is completely changes. And they say, wait, I'm the exact same weight as I was before. I physically look different. I physically feel different. And so it's evolving the mindset around like, the goal is to physically feel better and to physically be more healthy. And so the weight can be, it can be a challenging anchor because it depends on the goal. There is a time and a place for weight loss. Absolutely. Like, absolutely. That's without question. But when somebody is at a point in their life where they say, I just want to lose a little off my waist, it's like, well, you need different distribution. And that's going to come with not having the venti frappuccino, like that, the weight around your waist is because you're having, I don't even know what I think there are 60 or 70 grams of sugar in some of those frappuccinos. I mean, it's just like, it's absurd, right? And so you have one of those a day, maybe, like that's probably a thing. Some people mm-hmm. are having that a day plus other things, like
right.
That is what's sitting in the waistline, right? I don't understand. I eat kale salads and all these other things. Well, like the byproduct of that habit is where you physically don't feel good. And so it's like changing the lens through which people understand what certain inputs do to them. And they think it's minor because they'll say, I don't consume sugar. And then you sort of do the audit and you're like, what do you think that
right.
Slurpee, that coffee flavored Slurpee is that you have every morning? And how right. How does it make you physically feel? Like, oh, the crashing feeling at 10 a.m.? Yeah, that's that thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really hard, but it's understanding people's goals and then helping them to shift their lens of like, what do you really want to achieve? Because then once you get there, that's where people start to go, now I do want to understand, like educate me so that I can change my habits.
Right, right. Yeah. And I find that more people than not have tried diets throughout, you know, they don't really want a diet. They want to feel better. I've had mm-hmm. so many people tell me, I want to feel better. I want to get off these medications. All these medications have side effects, you know, so they are looking for some answers that some people are anyway. You know, they're looking for some answers that would get them so that they're not tied to all these medications and just not feeling good and and trying to, you know, to drink that energy drink just because they don't have energy, you know? So I've been really pleased actually with the way that most people don't want to be just straight up told, eat, you know, here's a piece of paper. This is what you're going to have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. People aren't really looking for that anymore. They're more looking more for strategies, and they really do seem to latch on to when I tell them, you know, two solid meals a day and a snack in between. That's kind of, you know, my pillar there too is let's eat twice really good. And, you know, another snack if you need it. And many people have really found that strategy to be what they were looking for. And, you know, coming back to you asked about the CGM, and I've been able to verify that lots of the meals that I have, you know, recommended to patients, then that those are, you know, that your blood sugar might go up 10 or 15 points max. I mean, you know, versus you throw a potato in there, it's going up. I mean, there's just, it's kind of hard for it not to. Just the idea that if you really do want to have good blood sugar control, I do know how to achieve that. And then, you know, figuring out how to be metabolically flexible then is the next, you know, case in point, is trying to figure that out. How many carbs can you tolerate, and trying to experiment. And that's probably where the CGM comes in, you know, because each person is going to be, you know, different in how they're going to process those carbs and what their food likes are, and everything about themselves is going to change. So I think that could be a beneficial eye opener to people understanding that.
Yeah, the data gives that extra layer of insight where, assume somebody says they've been, like, they've been trying everything, they've been following the prescriptive advice, but they don't realize that because sugar is hidden in so many things now, where, like, we'll make it up, it's a spinach salad and they eat some poppy seed, lemon poppy seed dressing, right? But they're not looking at that label and saying, like, what?
Like, and the sucralose. Not understanding what that's doing.
It'll be 14 grams of sugar, and you go in like 2 tablespoons, just something absurd. And that is like very normal to see those kinds of things on labels, but people don't check. And so they can't, they'll say, I want to achieve this goal, but they're having a challenge. As soon as you have the data, you can start to like dissect things and go, wait a minute, this thing that I thought I was doing for like 10 years straight is like definitely not helping me in any way, shape, or form. And so then you can adapt and you can make the right choices where you go, oh, like, I do assume it was somebody's habit. Like, they like to have the spinach salad for lunch that they make, and it's homemade except for that dressing. And they go, wait a minute, it's just like olive oil, lemon juice. Like, I can make that thing. And they just make their own dressing and they're like, that's easy. And then it changes things completely in the way that they feel, and helping to get to their goal of, like, over time that will compound all those micro things of changing the way that they approach their lifestyle choices.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Teaching people to read labels and understand what really is in their food. And like I was saying, the sucralose is one that, you know, when we look at artificial sweeteners and stuff, they're not, they may be using that skinny girl dressing. And then I have to tell them, well, it is lower calorie. If I could write Skinny Girl a message and say, hey, could you just change to stevia? I could promote your product. But the sucralose sneaking into the coffee creamers and all these things that people think they're doing themselves a service. And then when I say, it's probably driving your insulin level up, and, you know, we need to, you know, make some changes as far as that goes too. So just reading labels and trying to understand those things. But there's just so many misconceptions about which foods are healthy or not. That's the battle, is just trying to help people see what really is healthy, what's really making them feel better, not crash like you're talking about.
Yeah, it's almost marketing gone wrong. You see it all the time on whether it's cereal boxes or crackers, or I think it was last week, I saw a beer that said like vegan friendly, and I sort of did a check in my head, and I'm like,
yeah,
what, like, what wine
what does that
beer
mean?
Is not. Yeah, but it's like you've sort of everyone just can slap a label on things that say gluten-free or like, of course, T-bone steak is gluten-free. Like, of course it, you know, but people put these labels and then we've got this like heuristic because of marketing gone wrong where people will read that and they'll say, oh, this must be the healthy option because it says this thing. And like companies only put that thing if it is a healthy option. You know, yeah. You see it on Clif Bars, you see it on like just everything. You see it everywhere. And that's what's really challenging is that we've got, you touched on the idea of autophagy where we've been marketed to, we evolved for so many tens of thousands of years where that was our natural state. And now we've been marketed to the hours of 8 a.m. loosely, like 8 a.m., 12 p.m. and 5 p.m. Like when it hits that hour, like you eat.
Yes.
And it's like, and it doesn't even matter what you eat, but those are the times when you like put food in your mouth and you're like, what? Like, yeah. And then, and like having a late night snack too, that's like good for you. 9 p.m., 8 p.m. Like that's good for you. You know, people get sort of sold that like, well, that's what you do. And it's like, that's not what you do. Like that, your body needs to enter a state of repair and adaptability and resilience so that you, your mitochondria and all the things that are the byproducts of your body going into the state of repair can get into that, but you can't get there by just constantly feeding yourself and feeding yourself and feeding yourself. So there's ongoing education and helping the world understand it is exactly what we need more of.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, I spend so much time talking to people about their sleep and, you know, finding out, well, what time do you go to bed? And there are people who are night owls. I mean, I totally get that. But, you know, sometimes I think if you said, I need to get in bed by a certain time, and you said, I'm not going to eat within 2 to 3 hours of going to bed, I think going to bed would look a little more something you wanted to do versus eating the bag of chips or something up until you go to bed. I think people are, you know, eating snacks and things like that as a way to get that energy up until they go to bed, you know, mm-hmm. and then it's interfering with sleep. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I have loved using my Aura Ring plus the CGM to just kind of see how I can optimize my own sleep. And then again, try to come back to patients and say, I've tried this myself. I can understand, you know, really, truly, if you can stop eating within 2 to 3 hours of bedtime, that's going to be a benefit. So I like to practice what I preach, and then I like to experiment on myself so that I do know, you know, my firsthand, like this is, I can speak to this. This is how you correct it. I know what habits are driving some of these other behaviors, but let's see what we can do to change those habits.